Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with Martin Good to Go Willis.
I'm good to go.
Yep, that's what he tells the ladies. I'm good to go, ladies. And they're like, yeah. Oh, they get so excited when you tell them that, don't they?
Oh, yeah. They're good to go away when I say that. Yeah.
They're good. They turn around and run.
Yeah.
Yep. They're like, so are we. Oh, that's funny. So, let's see. So, we've got a good show today. I guess I'll tell people who I've got. I've got Larry Cates, and he is one of the guys who's part of that SCU team, the Scientific Coalition for Ufology. So, they're the guys who worked on the Aguadilla, Puerto Rico case.
Oh, okay.
So, just to bring people up to speed, that was the case where... a Homeland Security, essentially like kind of a border patrol plane in Puerto Rico, was taking off from the airport there in Aguadilla, and they, using their infrared camera, were able to, first with their eyes, they saw this light out in the ocean coming towards towards Puerto Rico, and then the light turned off. And so they trained their infrared on it, and they caught this object, and it flew across, and they feel it flew across the above the airfield and then went back out into the ocean. And when it got – and it seemed like it went into the ocean and came out and maybe even split into two objects. That's what some people suspect. And this is from the video, because the video's out there for people to look at. So SCU did an analysis of this video. Essentially, they agreed with that flight path, and they felt that the thing is anomalous, you know. So
I don't think
they don't have an explanation for it yet.
Yeah, I don't think too many videos have been looked at with quite this much scrutiny as that one film. And this is the first, now you may have said this before in the past, but this is the first time I've heard about any light in the beginning. I've never heard that before.
Oh, yeah, it's in my story and in their report. Huh. Yeah, and that is an interesting aspect, because most people are focused on the video and analyzing the video, because that's the data we have. That's the evidence. And however, that witness testimony is also pretty significant. In that a bird's not going to have a light on it, you know, neither will a balloon. And we go over some of the ideas, because some people think it maybe was a bird or a balloon. The FLIR expert I've spoken with, who works on those exact systems, he doesn't feel that. He feels that he doesn't know what the object is either. So, yeah, it's such an interesting case. So I've talked to many of the people involved with the case who were involved with the investigation, but I haven't talked to Larry yet. And he's great to talk to, because he's like in his 70s, and he's retired, a retired computer programmer. And so I also ask him about, you know, how he got all into this stuff and this great sighting, this amazing sighting that he had with his wife in the 80s. So,
wow.
Yeah. Goody. Fun interview.
Great.
Yeah, pretty cool. So, sit tight, people. But before that,
You know what? I'm gonna
What?
No, I'm gonna initiate the news today.
Oh, you are? Okay.
And you know how I'm gonna do that?
Huh?
I'm gonna pass the ball to you this week, because I've read this this article you wrote, and I think it's fascinating. So I'm going to have you start the news today, Alejandro, and tell us about the report of UFO over nuclear plant in Nebraska found in recently declassified documents.
Yeah, please. This is a great story. I did a great job investigating. I get all the credit for this. Just kidding. Actually, the person who should receive the credit for this one is John Greenwald of theblackvault.com. So yet again, he has hit a home run. I mean, I'm such a fan of his work because he digs. He uses the Freedom of Information Act to get UFO stories out. You know, one of them I haven't even written about. He got some National Park Service stuff, and I need to write about this. He told me about it. Luckily, he'll give me a heads up often. He'll say, hey, I just found this cool document. You know, here it is. Please don't post anything until I do. But, you know, gives me a heads up so I have some time to write something up. And in the case of the Park Service one, it was like a week before the conference or something. So I didn't have time to do anything with it. And I need to. And I'll tell you guys more about that maybe next week after I write something up. But this one is really cool. So what happened is Mr. John Greenwald asked for the UFO documents from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And these guys essentially, yeah, they look after nukes and nuclear facilities for safety and stuff like this. And they got back very quickly, within a matter of weeks, which is quick for a FOIA, and they gave him some files. The most interesting, about 43 pages of documents, actually, and there's only maybe two or three things in there, and you have, you know, what you would expect, some weird kind of letters like we receive, you know, and really, who knows how much veracity there is to these things, but essentially, like one person claiming that there's some radiation he encountered, and he thinks it's related to his daughter being abducted or something like that, and they're kind of like, well, not much we can do about that, sorry. And then another person claiming that, you know, nuclear-powered planes were crashed around the country, and they're like, well, we're not aware of this, and we're told that that didn't really happen, so... But the most interesting is a UFO case from Cooper Nuclear Station near Brownville, Nebraska. And this is really fascinating. So the document was a report of a UFO that they received in 2010 from a former security officer at this station. Now, the guy said, you know, nobody reported this, and it should have been reported at the time, but nobody did. So I was just thinking about it, and I was thinking, you know, that should have been reported, and the NRC should have been told about this. So here's my report on what I recall happening in sometime in 1986 and 1989. So sometime between 86 and 89. He couldn't remember exactly when. So it said he described an event while he was employed there, essentially that they observed a UFO that flew down the Missouri River, because this power plant is right on the Missouri River there. But this object flew down the Missouri River at about 150 feet in the air. It hovered in front of the intake, which is where he was, and I believe this is, you know, essentially a part of the base that, or the part of the power station that's next to the river. He saw it for a few moments. He contacted another security officer who also saw it, and then after they watched it for a while, it went back up the river, and that was it. And so, really weird. He said the next evening it happened again. They were there. The object came over. He said this time he didn't call anyone, but it came into the protected area. It hovered above one of the reactor buildings. He said the object was roughly triangular in shape with a circle of rotating lights on the bottom. He couldn't hear any noise from it. He believes that it was about a third the size of the reactor building, so pretty big. Mm. Once it did come into the protected area, that's when he kind of freaked out, and he called the security break room, where most of the officers were, I guess, hanging out in the break room. And they came and they saw it. It hovered for a few minutes, and then it moved outside of the protected area, returned back up the river, just like the night before, and that was it. So, yeah, really weird. Yeah, what a great case. So, the NRC did investigate. So, they did say, and this is kind of interesting. So, one of the funny statements is that when this report was emailed, you know, back and forth, because some of that correspondence is in here, they mentioned this is going to be a wild ride, you know, investigating this. But another one of the residents, the senior resident inspector, his name's Nick Taylor, he said that they looked for corroborating documents from the time, but they didn't find anything. However, he said, that doesn't mean this did not happen. He said back in the 80s, essentially, that they were not reporting things as frequently as they should have been. So he said in his search for reports from 1986 to 1989, he only found about 1,000, a little more than 1,000. However, these days, there are about 10,000 reports a year. So just to demonstrate how they didn't have as many reports. So it still could have happened. They also said that those people who also saw this UFO with the security guard are still working there. So even though this guy's retired, the others aren't. Mm. And they've been working there ever since the 80s, you know. So they did interview those people. However, unfortunately, the results of those interviews were not in these documents.
Mm.
Yeah. But
now,
if
those people are still working there, someone could, you know, I mean, in theory, get in touch with them or attempt to get in touch with them to talk about it.
You're exactly correct.
I would think.
Yeah, so I guess, and some people do that. You know, that's the kind of work that some of the Roswell investigators do. They'll just try to find out who works there and who are the security guards and call each one to ask them about it. But they may be aware that this story is out now, so they may be aware people are curious about it, but that would be worth the effort. That's a good idea. And the story at least got picked up by UK tabloid again, of course, who totally blew it out of proportion and said it was a TR-3B that invaded the base or whatever, which is... just pretty ridiculous. Of course, it's sensationalizing, making speculation and assumption, which reporters aren't supposed to do. But these tabloids are less than scrupulous when it comes to reporting.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no control over that.
Right. But you're right. This is a great case. Another great find from John Greenwald, which just shows, you know, the effort he takes to look for these documents is still worth doing and can still result in some very fascinating information.
Can you imagine the work that, I mean, no one really, I don't think people really think about it, but you imagine how much he has to sift through before he actually finds something of any, you know, consequence?
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. I give him a lot of credit, too.
Me, too. I mean, he's one of the hardest workers. He deserves. He's one of the shining lights in the UFO field. I think he's great. So
I asked a while back, I said to Stan Friedman, I said, who's the next Stan Friedman? And you know what? He said, John Greenwald.
Hmm.
That was interesting. I wasn't expecting that. But that's something I told John when I met him out there in Phoenix. And he was humbled by that, actually.
Hmm. That's pretty cool. Yeah, he's going to have to grow a beard.
Yeah, well,
I don't think I've ever seen him with any facial hair. Not about him.
He hasn't grown it yet.
Yep. He's a good guy. He's a lot of fun. Funny fella, too.
Yeah. So. Still young at heart. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He is young, though, at least compared to you and I.
Especially I know. Well, he started out at, 15 or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, he was just a kid, a teenager, little brat kid.
Amazing.
Yeah. Really cool stuff.
Yeah. So who's the next John Greenwald? That's what we have
the
to
next
find out.
John Greenwald. I don't know that there is another John Greenwald out there, but he's too young to be saying who's the next John Greenwald. But right. Another person doing great work, of course, along the lines of what he does is Paul Dean out of Australia.
Yeah, right.
I mean, he's mm-hmm. doing some great stuff. I mean, he's finding information that's already out there, but that people don't know about, and putting it together and bringing it to everyone's attention, which is invaluable. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of Paul Dean's work, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, do you have any news stories
yourself?
Yeah, sure.
Yourself? I got a story.
Oh,
we got
cool.
time?
Yeah, we sure do.
Okay. So this happened back in 2014, and it's a report of a disc UFO in New Jersey was the size of a football field, as
disc.
The witness claimed. Big disc. And they were driving home from work back on December 10th in 2014. And a quote from him: at the end of this long hilly road, you come to a four-way stop, the witness said. And he diagonally is a large empty field. And beyond the base, now this was the McGuire-Dix Lakehurst, you know, the joint base, military base. And once he got to the stop sign, he hit his brakes and in the middle of the road because there was this object above the field. And he says there were 12 or more lights lined up on it. And it could have been bigger than a football field, he says. And then he quotes, similar to the Phoenix Lights. So, maybe this is someone that's really looked at the topic to begin with. You know, I mean, that's what it seems like. So this, again, happened in a small town. Lakehurst is a borough of Ocean County, like 2,600 people or something like that. And so that was basically it. It sped, it went up and tilted at an angle and lit the lights up in a row and then sped up quicker and quicker and vanished completely without a trace. Another one of these things that vanished, whether it took off so fast you couldn't see it, you know, with the naked eye or not, or just plain did what they sometimes do, and that's plain vanish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting one. And that is, of course, the location of where the famous 1978 situation happened as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that's, you know, George Filer talks about that, where allegedly, you know, this vehicle landed. I think they said it was disc-shaped, and this creature came out, and they chased it, and it ran from one base to another. I think it ran from Fort Dix to McGuire, and then they shot it. And Filer's story is that he came to work. He was the intelligence officer, and they told him this story. They're all excited, and he's funny because they said they shot an alien. And he's like, oh, really? And he's thinking an illegal alien. And no, they're like an alien from space.
I know of this story. Yeah. No, yeah.
Yeah. So, and so they told him he had to go brief, you know, the general or whatever on it. And he's like, I don't want to tell him some alien came here. What are you guys even talking about? And so finally he didn't have to, but people were all excited and supposedly they shot an alien or something. So weird story. But, yeah, that was at this same location.
Wow. Wow.
Maybe it took them this long to come retrieve their buddy from wherever they were.
Yeah. They had trouble with GPS.
Yeah. It sent us to the wrong part of the galaxy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
A little mistake ended up being big.
Yep. That's a great one. Anything else?
That's it for me today.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Willis, for joining us with the news once again. Of course, all these stories can be read at openmind.tv. But unless you have anything else.
No, that's it. I'm done. Thank you.
Well,
thank you.
We are good to go to speak with Mr. Kate. So let's talk to him now. I am very excited to bring to the show for the first time Larry Cates. Hello, Larry.
Hi there.
So, you've done some work with the SCU group, and that is a group that investigated the Aguadilla, Puerto Rico case.
Uh-huh.
So, pretty exciting case. But let's get into, I guess, your history. When did you first begin to have an interest in this topic?
Well, way back in the 50s, the late 50s, and I grabbed a hold of the report on unidentified flying objects by Ruppelt.
Oh, yeah.
Ruppelt.
Uh-huh.
And that, as far as I'm concerned, is a major, major, still a major classic.
I agree. I think it's the most important book in this field, probably.
Very fun. Yeah. Yeah, very, very fundamental and contains a lot of good information in there. The whole thing, I mean, you know, I've been kicking it around for years in my younger years. Of course, when you, as life goes on, life gets in the way and you don't follow the things that, you know, you, really, really like all the time. Mm-hmm. And so, but it wasn't until 1998, wife and I were out for a drive and, we were pulling into a little shopping center, to do some stuff. And she says, "What is that?" And I looked and I saw it and I said, "Oh my gosh, I got to keep my eye on this and drive at the same time while I'm trying to pull in here," you know, because it was, I mean, right there over the small little shopping center, you know, and I couldn't tell you if anybody was there or not. I was so focused on that thing. It was about, you know, it was real close. I mean, it was within 500 feet.
Wow.
And it was low to the ground, but not so low that I couldn't see the top side of it because the angle was because it was so close to us. The angle was such that I couldn't see the anything but the underside of it. The top side I could not see. Anyway, I had, you know, we both watched it for just a few seconds, a couple seconds, and I jumped out of the car to get a better look because I got tired of looking through the windshield and trying to lean down between the windshield and the steering wheel. And I jumped out of the car and I got a real good look. And just as I did that, it quit its hovering stuff and just glided on off. And I didn't hear a thing other than traffic noise. I mean, it was close enough that I would have heard something, but it was clearly, you know, self-motivated. It had under its own propulsion of some kind. And, you know, I know to this day, with stone cold certainty that, you know, they are here. That was a machine I saw. And it was a machine not of our, made by humans. It was not. That thing was, it was just odd colored and there was so many uncertainties about it. And I stood there fascinated for a second until it started drifting off behind the canopy on the gas station I'd pulled into. And I ran around there and it went ahead and just, you know, picked up speed and went off. It didn't do any, you know, major maneuvers or anything like that. But its silence and it was closeness and, you know, that kind of closeness leaves virtually no room for uncertainty about the fact that you don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. What did
other than the fact that it was a machine.
What did it look like? What was its shape?
It was circular.
Mm-hmm.
And on the underside, it was glowing with the kind of, and it kind of looked like those orange streetlight colors a little bit, but very, very faint. It was, and you couldn't tell. It was the light was such that you couldn't quite tell whether it was like, was this reflected light or because it was very scattered. It was very, that no distinct images on the bottom like a real reflection.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a generalized glow underneath. And that's its main feature. It was circular. I could not see the top side of it. And it just glided on off and picking up speed as it went.
So kind of like the traditional disc type of thing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And my guess is it was about 50 to 75 feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm. Pretty large.
Yeah, pretty large. And, but that's just an estimate. You know, you don't have a measuring tape. All you got is just guesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was in
1998. Mm-hmm. What time of day was it?
It was nighttime, about nine after nine, sometime in the evening toward the winter.
Okay.
It was September of 98.
So dark by then.
Oh, yeah. Very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what effect did that have on you and your wife?
The only thing that was there is just, well, the effect is, of course, you know, well, while we talked about it for a couple of days, but that was about it, and it kind of fell by the wayside a little bit. But, you know, it kept gnawing on the back of my mind, gnawing and gnawing and gnawing. And finally, after 10 years, it takes me a while, I guess, for things to dawn on me for how, you know, the reality of it sets in. It just takes that while. And like I say, I know with stone cold certainty that they're here. Mm-hmm. And that we are, you know, this universe is so cotton picking big. I mean, 14 billion light years in diameter, maybe more, you know, 14 billion years old. And almost every star you see, nearly every one of them has got a planetary system of some sort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we just have no clue. I mean, we just have zero idea of what's out there. I mean, we barely scratch the surface with that little bit of knowledge that we've got with our local solar system here and with the light. And that's virtually all of our knowledge of the universe is derived from mathematics and the light that gets to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it. And beyond that, you know, there you have the guesses of the astronomers, which, you know, we're not very imaginative, really, when it comes to comparing ourselves to the universe. The universe is far more imaginative than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And in extreme detail, everything just exists in extreme detail. And I do mean extreme, right down to the subatomic level. I mean, way down there. Everything is really has crystalline precision.
Mm-hmm.
Except when we, as far as we know, except when we get really down there, as far as we know, there's a little problem because, you got quantum mechanics and all the uncertainty involved in there and all the jittering around of, the electrons and the protons and so forth. You know, the motions of these things is very blurred, and there's, you know, the uncertainty principles about, being able to pin down the position of the object and its speed at the same time. You can't do it. There's just all these uncertainties when you get down to that level.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, I forgot my train of thought there.
What almost seems like, especially when you put it that way about, you know, all the planetary systems that are out there, that it's almost, it seems just as likely that we would be able to hear a signal, that we would be able to see a visitor. I mean,
oh, that's the whole SETI thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the issue. There are several issues to explain why that might not happen,
mm-hmm.
Even with the massively advanced technologies. And that, you know, that is the Fermi paradox. He had the question, where are they? You know, we do all the calculations. We know that there should be fantastically advanced, technologically advanced civilizations out there. But so where are they? How come they're not here?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he was asking that with the presumption that, you know, all the crap that happened, you know, in 1947 and beyond, 1950s and all those kinds of things, those sightings. But he was also in the presence of, let's see, what was that guy's name? He was another nuclear engineer, and I can't quite remember his name right now, but he was just adamantine against UFOs. He just, you know, they don't exist, and that's all there is to it. And, you know, Fermi kept saying, well, he kept doing a soft sell on it, on his approach, saying, well, you know, if I admit that they're, that you say that they're not here, then where are they? Because all the calculations show otherwise. And so, there's that.
Well, what do you think of that question?
The SETI question, yes. I think that the answer to the fact that we don't hear any yet, if you really read it, there's a world of precarious situations under which we would likely catch that signal. First off, you know, we can't see anything except within at most, what, 300 light years maybe at most, because leakage, the radio waves follow the R square law. They just get weaker and weaker and weaker with distance. Mm-hmm. And we have to have our equipment has to be more and more and more sensitive, and we just have a great deal of trouble trying to detect that. And I'm all for them trying to do that. I mean, there's other technologies that can be derived from what they do indirectly, but the fact remains that the signal is really difficult to detect. Mm-hmm. And faint. And furthermore, there's the issue of, well, how advanced are they, you know, in comparison to when do they just drop analog electronics altogether and move on to digital electronics, or even, you know, sub-quantum bands, who knows, you know. Mm-hmm. So you name it. There's any number of reasons why we're not detecting that signal, but we're not.
Mm-hmm. So, after your sighting, did that kind of reinvigorate or really motivate you to get more involved with looking into the UFO topic?
Over the 10-year period? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it grew and grew and grew on me until I just said, okay, I'm going to sit down here and just go through the Blue Book records that were archived on the web in detail. Mm-hmm. And I especially focused on the July 19th and the week after, was it 25th or thereabouts, mm-hmm. of July 1952, really focused on that period in a lot of detail, and just totally fascinated by what I found. All the hubbub and all the crap that was created by that. And it fell completely silent in the general public after the initial hubbub. Even Truman got involved back then, saying, "Hey, what's going on here?" Mm-hmm. With that 1952 Washington thing. And Sanford, General Sanford, the one that held the press conference afterwards, totally, he was able to actually squash the whole episode with smoke and mirrors. He was. And the crap that he pulled, I mean, there's all kinds of shenanigans that he pulled. The people that were directly involved with the incident, he kept them out of the conference. They were not even allowed there.
Right, which is documented very well in Ruppelt's book.
Yeah. Yeah. That, well, it's been documented in a lot of different places.
Mm-hmm.
The press conference that followed, you know, and if you read the press conference in detail closely, you will see how he just did a lot of soft shoe. You can see it. And it just really irks me that there was you can bet your bottom dollar they had a major interest in finding out what the dickens these things were.
Mm-hmm. I think it's changed a little bit more recently, but you know, for so long, it's the public was clamoring for a simple explanation, I think, just so they can put it to rest and move on with their lives. And so even with the closing of the Blue Book and everything, people didn't look too deeply into things. They just accepted the answers they were given and moved on.
Yeah, I agree. I agree, but the thing of it is that when you're involved in your day-to-day life, you know, you're more interested in putting bread on the table than you are in anything else.
Yeah.
And so you have a hand-to-mouth in existence, relatively speaking, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so people by and large are more interested in their daily lives than they are, you know, saying, well, yeah, this is interesting, but, you know,
yeah,
there's more important things. Because in the importance of that, the relative importance of that is because they don't give it that much.
Mm-hmm. And is that how you felt, you think, over the years? Well, you had this really burning interest, this great interest in the topic. Were you busy with your career? That
yes.
Probably was your main focus, huh?
Yes, it was. You know, I had an interest, and it'd be like, well, it'd occur from time to time. Well, this is interesting. That's interesting. Move on. It wasn't like, you know, the major focus that I had in just prior to 2008.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are like that. I think the majority of the listeners of the show are probably like that, which, you know, I don't fault anybody because, like you said, you got to put bread on the table. Luckily for me, I mean, if I had children, I might be completely different. I might have never gotten so into all of this stuff. But yeah, I think that, you know, I kind of talked about that at the last conference. That's what really keeps, you know, people are limited in the time and what type of time and effort they can spend on their own interests when they have children and careers that they have to pay attention to.
Uh-huh. And that is far more important naturally than something that may or may not be true to them.
Mm-hmm. So what was your career?
Computer programming. We had work with a small company that did micro to mainframe communications.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to do the software to accomplish that goal. And it was interesting work. I mean, you know, the banks loved us to death for mm-hmm. a while until mm-hmm. the advent of the internet, and then we died.
Mm.
So but you by then I was ready to retire anyway. So
you guys were a precursor to the internet.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We predated the internet. We had, you know, this was back when modems were still the form of communication.
Mm-hmm.
That lasted, 10 years or so, primarily. And the business about the internet came about, and just, I mean, it was so obviously better than modems. It was unreal.
Mm-hmm.
Because they, that is, I mean, they developed the equipment far and above modems, better equipment, so that made the internet far more possible.
Well, let me ask you this question. This is kind of an out there kind of question, but just as someone who was there during, you know, watching all of this technology being developed, there are some people out there who believe that the internet or some of these communications technologies that we have now, because they grew so quickly, have their origins possibly in back engineering alien technology. Do you believe that to be the case, being someone who was, you know, with right in there working with this technology during this development?
Not so much.
Mm-hmm.
I think now, could there be influences? Yeah, do I think that there's a possibility of that? Yes, but, you know, proving it and showing it and demonstrating it, getting some concrete about it, impossible practically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, it's the same sort of thing. I mean, does telepathy exist? We're still kicking that around. There's a guy named John, J-A-H-N, doctor, that did some research in that about people's ability to influence very small pieces of equipment and small behaviors but real nonetheless, to actually influence. So telepathic and that sort of paranormal sort of stuff is really very sub-infant right now. It's we're just scratching the surface of it. To what degree it really exists, I really don't know. But there's all kinds of reports of telepathy things going on and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that actually has an influence where they could influence people, you know, you've heard scientific ideas being in the wind where two or more scientists come up with the same idea at the same time,
mm-hmm.
And produce a thing. And this ideas in the wind kind of thing is very difficult to determine whether that influence or just simply a naturally occurring event. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but by and large, I think we can credit ourselves for that because there's a very concrete trail mm-hmm. of development that you can see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes I think, you know, when we don't understand something, we're a little too quick to jump to conclusions. And it unfortunately negates the extremely great work that some very capable humans have done.
We've trod on major pieces of work over and over and over again. But luckily for us, we had the wherewithal to finally recognize its true value.
Mm-hmm. So once you retired, was it after you retired that you then joined MUFON?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And did you become a field investigator?
I became a field investigator at that time, yes.
And how was that experience for you?
it was eye-opening mm-hmm. because you got to actually talk to some people that were involved in sightings. And over the years, I've found that there's a few gems among all the sewage.
Mm-hmm. The gems, how did they affect you?
Oh, they were affected me greatly because there was something substantial you could get your teeth around, to something you could hold on to say, hey, well, here's something of physical evidence or at least some circumstantial evidence for things. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any cases with actual physical evidence?
Sure, photos.
Okay.
There was one down in Florida
mm-hmm.
That I had where a football-shaped, the best thing to call it is a probe. That fits the best description. What it really was, I don't know, but it best fits our concepts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a red football-shaped thing. And it would, you know, the guy, it was gliding along the ground, and the guy kept trying to fiddle with his camera and chase it while he was trying to take pictures of it. And the last two of them, he managed to get the flash on, but he was trying to do, you can see from the EXIF data, that's the data that's embedded in the picture,
mm-hmm.
That you can actually pull it out and analyze it because it has things like, you know, whether or not the flash was engaged, you know, what the time is for what the settings were for the, you know, the focus and autofocus and that, all those kinds of camera settings on there. He had in detail, you could mark it down and you could see, you could even read the excitement of the guy through these things because mm-hmm. he was sitting there crazily trying to make these massive adjustments on these things on this camera in a hurry. And you can see how he was sloppy in doing it. The picture was full of light trails and, you know, because he didn't get the flash enabled until the last minute. But the first view, the exposure was too long and the light trails were real long, and which actually helped. You know, the light trails helped analyze the picture because it helped eliminate a lot of possible hoax things and that sort of thing, because you could actually see the three dimensionality buried in the light trails, you know, relative to the background.
Mm-hmm.
So the light trails made a certain movements and the backgrounds made a light made those light trails of streetlights and so forth, made certain movements. And comparing the movements, you can see, you know, three-dimensional effects. And so it, you know, wasn't staged in his garage or anything. And it also wasn't staged where Mark D'Antonio got his, he suggested, well, maybe the guy did it with lasers. Because one of the things we did notice is that when you changed the red and the green and the blue filters, you know, you separated those components out in the picture. You have some red components, some green components, and some blue components to the contributing to the intensities of the picture, and the red component was always visible, but the green and blue of that object were absolutely missing completely. They were not there. They were just not there. And Mark said, well, the only thing that does that is a pure frequency of light, like a laser light. And he said, well, maybe just a, you know, the way he did it was laser on glass or something. But, you know, this guy's moving along, taking a picture. And you can see that from the EXIF data that, you know, there's a certain amount of time in between each picture, you know, and a lot of the times that was taken between these pictures was him fiddling with the camera, trying to get change the settings on it.
Mm-hmm.
And not anything else, not fiddling with the background. I mean, he just didn't have enough time to do it. That was clear. And you can see, again, you could see the frantic activity he had because he was within 4 or 5 feet of the thing, taking pictures, chasing it down.
I remember hearing about this case somewhere.
Yeah, it was a very good one. And here's the kicker. When he took the picture with a flash, the red component was still there, pronounced, but there was a faint green and blue component as well with a flash, as if the flash bounced off of something and created that green and blue component.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. I mean, you know, hoaxers are going to think of this. Come on. I doubt it. I mean, it would, I'll put it this way. He was a damn good hoaxer if he did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like a really good one.
Yeah. Those are the kinds of things that I'm talking about are substantial cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the reason I asked you that question is because, you know, I always tell people, because I kind of got to the point where I got really into things like you did. I read a lot of stuff, a ton of stuff. I mean, I was just, like, obsessed with reading everything and watching everything I could for a year or so. And I finally felt like I got to the end of all the material that I was interested in. And so I decided, well, I'll become an investigator. I'll find out more. And it is impactful when you talk to these witnesses and you find, you know, those gems, like you said, of these very credible people with these extraordinary things that they've seen. And they are they have an effect on you. I mean, it really is fascinating.
Uh-huh.
So I definitely recommend people, if they're really into this, to do that. I mean, unfortunately, not everybody has a lot of time. Sometimes they can only devote, you know, a few months, maybe a year or two to doing it, and then they have to move on. But it's worth doing, I think.
Very much so, if you got the time.
Yeah.
If you got the time, it's very much worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of evidence is there is, you know, kind of funny. You know, and I pretty much think that's by design. I think that, you know, I think there's more than one civilization. There's evidence for more than one civilization,
mm-hmm.
not only visiting us, but there's evidence for multiple civilizations out there, in terms of just, the numbers of planets and the numbers of stars. Just that alone, would suggest that. You know, provided that evolution has gone pretty well like clockwork everywhere.
And assuming, I guess, that they've survived the kind of crossroads where we're at, where we've got the
that's another possibility for the signal not being there. Mm-hmm. But then, if they're visiting here, which I had, like I say, with cold known certainty, they are, they have developed past that point where the technology didn't kill them.
Right. And you know what? I always talk about this. In fact, I was talking with someone about this recently, that most or many of scientists agree with you with what you said there, that Stephen Hawking doesn't, but Carl Sagan, Michio Kaku, I've heard others say the same thing, that if they've been able to develop these weapons of mass destruction. Oh, yeah, yeah, more and more. And if they're able to develop these weapons, but not use them to just destroy themselves and get past that, then most likely they are, yeah, just more well-developed socially as well.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Mm-hmm. Because you got this parochial stuff that can go on, you know, where they are just interested in their own groups, you know, and are self-protective of their own group, but not of everybody else necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. So very interesting. But you were getting back to also that the type of sightings that we see or information we obtain is sort of by design.
I do believe that they allow us to see only what they want us to see.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it would make a lot of sense, particularly if they are as advanced technologically to get here. They have very well developed chemistry, physics, and sciences, well developed.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, who knows what they've done to themselves? They have who knows what issues, ethical issues they face over, you know, genetic engineering or convergence with machines, you know, incorporating machines in their own bodies and that kind of stuff. Who knows? Who knows? We don't know. But I have little doubt that they have enhanced their own intelligence because they realize the value of it. And having, you know, done that, they will be able to have easily very clear cut. I mean, clear to them, not to us, but to them, clear cut plans to how to handle civilizations such as ours, which it just assumed kill them is not.
Right. And we would have, even our governments and militaries would have very little ability to monkey with those plans. Maybe slightly, but I doubt at you know, greatly.
They're not going to be able to make a scratch in them at all to speak of. I agree with that. And so whatever plan it is, it's going to be virtually inevitable.
Right. So, I mean, and I don't, at least for me, my view on disclosure is more along the lines we keep hammering at the, you know, pounding at the White House doors when really it's not up to them. It's more up to, you know, we need to be pounding on the door of the disc you saw. But unfortunately, we can't do that. But it's up to the guys upstairs.
Yeah, well, it's up to, what do you mean, upstairs?
I mean, like, the if there are visitors, they're the ones who, we're working on their timeline.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely correct.
So, Aguadilla, I guess, is that one of the most exciting cases maybe you've ran across?
It is one that has massive amounts of data to it, massive amounts. And what might be the interest in that doing that kind of stuff with the Aguadilla things? I mean, you know, we always do the stuff, well, here's the position, here's the speed, and, you know, here's the direction, and here's the location, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, all that's fine and good. But, you know, so what? What is really important is, you know, trying to find out, trying to glean information about what are they up to? What are they doing? Why are they doing it? What are our estimates of? I know we can't know, but what are our estimates? What are they, you know, what are they doing through their action? What are they showing us? And just, and we'll just assume, like, under the fundamentals game theory, for example, that they control every move practically, and that they are going to have a plan for everything as far as, you know, we're concerned. Mm-hmm. And I forgot what I was going to head for here.
with the Aguadilla case. And
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Aguadilla case, but the important thing there is, well, can we refine our measurements of everything there? I mean, there's a massive amount of information, and can we refine our measurements enough to pick up things like, is there accelerations and, you know, even changes in directions or an acceleration, of course, and just those kinds of things. And but see, here's an additional dimension to the information that we have, and we've got infrared intensities from that thing. Mm-hmm. And the infrared intensities, you start to ask questions like, well, are the infrared intensities having anything to do with propulsion, or is it just related to data collection? You know, what the dickens can it be? And the more information we can glean, for example, if we could actually determine this, I don't know if we can, but over time we might be able to some degree determine whether those infrared emissions, you know, fluctuate in relation to, if there's any statistical relationship at all, to the motions and accelerations, and that kind of thing. So that would tell us whether or not those, if there is no, you know, basically no relationship, then that would tell us that the infrared emissions don't have much to do in relation to the power, you know, how it's powered and its guidance systems and stuff, in relation to how it maneuvers, where it gets its ability to maneuver from. Does it get its ability to maneuver through using something related to that infrared emission? Well, if there is no relation, then no. Then likely the other issue would be it would be used for data collection, which also makes a lot of sense, because take a look how much information we've gathered from the universe and how much we know about the universe from the light, electromagnetic waves alone, just by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much we gain from that. And like I say, if they refine their sciences, they can get a whole hell of a lot more information from electromagnetic waves than we can.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly since the advent of quantum mechanics really shows, you know, the in deep relationships to information that this stuff has, mm-hmm. electromagnetic waves. And so if this thing is just flashing these infrared waves all over the place in random ways and that kind of stuff, it may be just due to the data collection. Mm-hmm. And why that may be, in what way that those things change frequencies and that kind of thing may give us a clue. I don't know. So there's lots of very interesting questions to follow up here.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you some questions. I want to go over at least three possibilities, or at least three items people have suggested perhaps the Aguadilla object is. Now, of course, these are people who have not yet put in the work you all have in analyzing that video. But for instance, one of the theories was that it's a bird and that it lands on the water and other birds fly away. That's why it looks as though it's splitting in two. What do you think of that theory?
I think that theory is very, very, very unlikely given the data given. If you take a close look at the data, it doesn't support that notion very much at all. Mm-hmm. Very little support for it. In the data.
Uh-huh. And like, what in particular data pieces do you think negate that theory?
For example, they say that it separated into two parts, mm-hmm. and that was due to the appearance of, you know, two birds flying together and the other one flying off. Well, actually, the way the things split and the way that the it came apart and the way it separated, if you take a look at it frame by frame, it doesn't look like at all that in terms of three-dimensional respects that one bird was behind another. And not only that, you have wing movements and you got that kind of thing that are just not present.
Right. And I think that's the biggest argument. You know, there's that FLIR expert who's also looked at it, and that's one of his big ones against a bird. It just doesn't move like a bird would. I mean, if you look at the video and if you compare it to a video of a bird flying, it moves very differently. It doesn't move like a bird at all.
Yeah. And there's a lot of interesting little infrared things that we could do. I would really love to do if I had the money and to invest in equipment, but because the questions alone are just in themselves interesting.
Mm-hmm. The other one is that it's a balloon, that it's not moving very far, that the plane is moving around a balloon. And so the background looks like it's moving more quickly than it is, and it's a balloon that's not moving very far. What do you think of that theory?
That it has more substance to it than the bird thing,
right?
Quite a bit more. And there is a lot of physical support for that theory in terms of the trigonometry. The geometry of the situation. There is a lot of support for it. And I am continuing to look at that in closer and closer detail. I'm not at all convinced that it's a balloon. There's lots of different ways. But, you know, the trick is, of course, is to, you know, find the aha thing where, yeah, for sure, we've nailed it. You know, it's not a balloon. And, for one of those things is like the speed of the thing. You know, if you measure the speed at 76 miles an hour, well, not a balloon.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, the explanation as to the balloon looking like it fades out and splits in two is that the plane had at that point moved further away. And so it's just distortion.
That's if you got a balloon in the first place. You
right.
got problems. You got problems saying that it's a balloon after you've seen the 76 mile an hour thing.
Yeah, and
so you can't say that any longer.
Yeah, and the FLIR expert he makes a great point in that it's way too hot to be a balloon.
That is the other issue. Yes, I took made several ways of trying to get the temperature out of that thing. I mean, trying to get information out of these companies that are half into they have to protect their technology, but also there's secrets that they don't want the bad guys to know. And so they keep the clamp down because we've got Customs and Border Patrol going on here and
right.
smuggling, and that's what they're trying to keep at bay. But when you got these issues about how they protect the technology, it makes it very difficult to get information about the product, about these cameras. But we manage, we compare. You can see, for example, there's cows in the background back there, and you can see the temperatures of the cows, the little guys back there. And we know that what the skin temperature, surface temperature of the cows are, and you can kind of make some guesstimates of this is the measurement of the in terms of infrared, what the temperature is. So there's ways we can do this, and they're based on science, of course.
And then the third is the possibility that it's some high-tech secret military drone or something like that.
That is, I think, the hardest one to counter. But the problem is, well, first of all, the infrared emissions and the power source and all that kind of stuff would have to be overcome. But, you know, who's to say the NSA hadn't done that? I don't know. But why are they testing it over Puerto Rico, for crying out loud? Why?
Yeah, and over an airfield. Those are great questions. And the propulsion that's being used, it's not prop propellers. So it would
It has to be jet or rocket.
Yeah.
If it's our technology, because we, and I guarantee you, we do not have even the theory for any sort of other thing than jets and props and engines of various kinds. We just don't. We just do not. I mean, we've got, you know, lighter than air and hydrogen, you know, and all of that, but that's like,
So I mean, to your point with these you know, top three theories, is that the latter is going to be the hardest to definitely take off the list, but that for those who subscribe to the prior two, they've got some answers to give. I mean, they have to answer the questions that you raised, and thus far they have not. I mean, I don't think answered those questions yet.
Yeah, and until then, I'm going to pursue, you know, all the other stuff as if the assumptions that I'm making and the conjectures that I'm making are true.
Mm-hmm.
And so you move ahead with that because it's fascinating to think about.
Mm-hmm. So given this case and some of, you know, the other cases you've worked on, Do you feel that this field is moving along, that we are learning things? Do you have a positive outlook?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, like a, you know, a drunken man riding a horse follows a straight line. You know, it's that thing.
Right. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're meandering roughly in the right direction. But, I mean, geez, you know. It's like tracking along a menagerie of noise.
Uh-huh. What do you think the best path forward is?
Science.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability to admit there's things we do not know.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, really well-known scientists have got up there and said, well, you know, when – somebody said, you know, if a scientist says this is what the crap did he say? I can't remember right now. Anyway, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, your schooling. Do you have a science background?
Yeah, I've got a bachelor's in math.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so science is, and you know, there's never really been a thorough or focused application of science in this field, at least an ongoing. I mean, even when you get back to the Air Force, it's been kind of, you know, not fully committed.
Even when you get back to what?
The Air Force.
Oh, yeah, they're still chasing the blasted things. I don't know.
Yeah.
They don't have the technology, but they want it. They don't have it.
Yeah.
But you know, the technology and stuff is
All right. So I guess we are pretty much out of time. So I guess for, you know, someone who's been in this for quite a while, what would you say to people? What would you say to them to, you know, where is the best way for them to focus their efforts?
Detailed research of first the history and then of the cases that follow your interest thereafter that are substantial and have data connected with them, something that you can show scientifically.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure.
All right, and you're going to continue working on Aguadilla and other cases that come your way, I'm assuming.
Oh, very definitely. Aguadilla, there's, like I say, there is a ton of data buried there.
Mm-hmm. And you're still digging.
I'm still digging.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much for your effort in doing that. It is a remarkable case, and I think you guys did a great job looking into that. And for at least for me, it still remains a mystery as well.
Yeah. All right, Alejandro.
All right. Well, we will talk to you later. Thank you so much.
And again, like I say, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much to Larry Cates for joining us on the show. It's always fun to talk to these people who have been interested in this topic for so many years and have been around to see the evolution. I mean, stuff that many of us know as history, some of these people got to witness. I mean, I unfortunately was not alive when Ruppelt was alive, the guy who wrote the book that he's talking about. By the way, I know I've said this before. It's a must-read book, Report on Flying Saucers by Ruppelt, who actually was the guy who started. He was the first chief for Project Blue Book. But remember, Blue Book didn't start until 1952. It was actually the third project regarding UFO investigations. Well, of the big projects after Sign and Grudge. But there were other UFO projects like Project Twinkle and others. He talks about some of these in his book, but there were other, one-off kind of projects to look at different things. But very, very important book. Really interesting to hear that it had such a great influence on him as well, because it did on me, and it's a very important book. But beyond that, great to hear about his UFO sighting and the great work on the Aguadilla case. So if you want to see more about that case and or to see the video, go to openminds.tv and in the search, just put in like Puerto Rico. You don't have to try to spell Aguadilla. It's a little difficult to spell, although it's spelled just like it sounds. And I, as you can tell, I love to say the word Aguadilla. So check that out, because the video is really cool. Their report is very important, and see if you can figure out what the heck is going on. Anyhow, that is it for today. Let's see, what do we got out there? Oh, I don't know if I told you all this. In fact, I don't think I did, because I don't think I had it up last week. But I did put up free on YouTube a video of me talking at Phoenix MUFON. And I was discussing the international UFO organizations out there. So these are the official government UFO organizations that exist in other countries. They are out there. And the reasons they became, they got interested and created these departments are fascinating. I mean, some really incredible cases. I go over the UK a bit and I go over their history a bit. Canada and the U.S. just a little bit to kind of set the stage, because so many people followed the U.S.'s lead when it came to investigating UFOs. That's why that aspect was really important and something I had to cover at the beginning. But it's about 2 hours long. It was here in Phoenix for the Phoenix MUFON in December. Dennis Fryermuth, who owns Sunburst or Sunrise production company. He's actually a videographer, and he's the one who records their talks now and puts these together. He's also their chief investigator, and he's one of the best. It's one of the best groups in the country, and he's one of the best chief investigators in the country, IMHO, in my humblest of opinions. They're really great. So, and he did a great job putting this video together, and I'm very happy they allowed me to post it. And so it's free. It's 2 hour discussion on all of this stuff for free on the Open Minds YouTube. So you can go to our website and find it, or go to YouTube and put Open Minds Production or Alejandro Rojas or international UFO or government UFO agencies, stuff like that, and you'll find it. So check that out. Otherwise, we've always got new stories, like those stories that Martin and I talked about. But by the way, so go to openminds.tv for that. And don't forget to subscribe to the video on demand. So if you go to openminds.tv, you're going to find ads all over the site, actually, for our video on demand, where you can see past UFO lectures from the UFO Congress, including ones like Bob Lazar and George Knapp and Jacques Vallée and several from Stanton Friedman and Travis Walton, witnesses you can't see anywhere else regarding the Travis Walton case. So lots of great videos there for a very small monthly subscription. So please go do that. And the reason I'm practically begging you to do this here is because we don't charge for practically anything. That's the only thing we charge for, that in our conference, really. So we give a lot of information out there for free. And so it's very helpful if you can just support us in this small way. You get a lot for it, and it costs very, very little. So we'd be very grateful if you would go and subscribe to our video portal. And you'll find that at openmind.tv. Also, subscribe to our newsletter, email newsletter, where we send you information about all the latest going on. And that's enough plug-in stuff for me. But hey, it's good stuff. It's lots of valuable information that I know you all will greatly enjoy. Assuming you enjoy this podcast. If you didn't, you wouldn't be here. So thank you all for listening. Of course, thank you to Martin for helping out with the news. And then also, and remember, check out his podcast, UFO. Thank you to Caleb Hanks for the opening and close music. And thank you to you all for listening once again. You don't know how much, how important it is and how grateful I am that you guys come back every week to listen. I really am very grateful that you're here to share in the experience of being able to talk to people like Larry and, you know, get the fascination and the history and to me, that sort of thing's inspiring, listening to people like him who are, you know, out there doing stuff and putting in time and effort to try to discover and to hear what they have to say and their history, to me, is just so much fun. It's invaluable. So I hope you enjoy it too. And with any luck, I can never guarantee, at least not this week, because I don't have anything set in stone, but most likely I'll have another show on Monday. I'll do my best to do so. And I have some ideas for people to talk to, so no worries there. So join me next week for another great Open Mind UFO radio podcast. Until then, adios muchachos. Another reason to stay.